will now come to order. It is now 3:04 p.m. Tuesday, January 23rd, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Speaker Edgman, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, Representative Sadler, and myself. Let the record reflect that we now have a quorum to conduct business. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already done so for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Hess Secretary, and Susie Edwardson, who is in training, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee meeting today. We have two items on the agenda today. First up is a presentation on the topic of domestic violence and the role of contraceptive coercion in domestic violence. Representative Matt Klayman, the sponsor of House Bill 25, which relates to contraceptives, will introduce the topic, and then we'll go and hear from a few invited speakers. Second, we'll hear House Bill 162 by the governor, which deals with laws surrounding the Department of Health and Social Services criminal and civil history background checks. So first up, we're going to turn our attention to the issue of contraceptive coercion. Representative Klayman is the sponsor of House Bill 25, which deals with the topic. We'll introduce the issue, and then we'll go into the additional presenters.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman. I'm the State House Representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. And first off, I want to thank you all for being here for this afternoon. Last year, I introduced House Bill 25, legislation related to insurance coverage for contraceptives. House Bill 25 received three hearings in this committee, as well as three hearings in the House Finance Committee. During those hearings, citizens across Alaska shared how important it is to expand health birth control access by giving every woman full access to birth control methods that work for her without barriers on cost or availability. We also heard from women, especially in rural areas, that multiple trips a year to the pharmacy can be an insurmountable barrier in accessing consistent contraception, and that a one-year supply would assist many women in balancing their personal health with work and family life. Since last session, there has been an increased awareness on the national level and here in Alaska on the issue of domestic violence and sexual assault. Movements such as Me Too and Time's Up have made it clear that we need to do more as a society to support those that have experienced and may be currently experiencing different types of domestic violence and coercion. And I've become particularly aware from folks that have contacted my office about the issues of reproductive coercion, also known as contraceptive coercion, which is a form of domestic and interpersonal violence that is perpetuated by abusers. Advocates and those who have experienced this type of coercion have shared stories about contraceptive coercion in which abusers dictate when and how contraceptives can and cannot be accessed as a means of gaining power and control. And this is done in a number of ways. It can come from hiding, withholding, or destroying a partner's birth control to deliberately cause pregnancy. It can involve intentionally breaking condoms and removing contraceptive rings or patches. It can involve lying about birth control, such as lying about having had a vasectomy. It can include forcing a partner to forego birth control. It can include threatening to leave unless a partner becomes pregnant, threatening to have a baby with someone else if the partner doesn't comply with the request to become pregnant, and forcing a partner to become pregnant or end a pregnancy against her will. This kind of deplorable behavior and blatant disregard for women's health and women's rights and women's autonomy is inexcusable. Today's hearing is an opportunity to make good on our responsibility as legislators to educate ourselves on issues like contraceptive coercion and acknowledge it as a serious type of abuse. And today the committee will hear testimony from three individuals. Danielle Campamore, who currently lives in New York but grew up and was a former resident of Eagle River. Danielle will be sharing her experiences and powerful perspective as someone who has experienced domestic violence and contraceptive coercion. Our second speaker is Ginny Walsh, program coordinator for the Arctic Women in Crisis Center in Uktiavik, Alaska. The Alaska Women in Crisis Center provides emergency shelter and counseling services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And our final invited speaker is Michelle Overstreet, the founder and executive director of My House in Wasilla, Alaska. My House is a homeless drop-in center that provides services to young people in need. By providing consumers a 12-month supply of birth control and expanding choices for women to include long-acting reversible contraception, Haspel 25 critically enables victims and survivors by assisting those who are attempting to live as safely as possible in the short term while they work towards longer-term safety. Contraceptive coercion is a public health issue, and it is also a public safety issue. By giving women and families access to affordable and reliable contraception, we can help current and potential victims of abuse. And with that, I will turn it over to our invited speakers.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the committee for Representative Klayman? Representative Sadler. Oh, one moment. I'm so sorry. I wanted to make sure that we acknowledge that Representative Keto joined us at about 6 minutes after the hour.
You described a kind of sexual assault known as contraceptive coercion or denial, and my question would be briefly, if an abusive partner is able to keep oral contraceptives from a woman for 1 or 2 or 3 months, how does extending that to a year make any qualitative difference in the level of abuse or denial?
Representative Sadler, there's a number of different explanations, but I actually, in listening to the stories, including the advocates that are going to be testifying, I think you should listen to their stories before you hear from me.
All right. All right, seeing no additional questions, we're going to go to Danielle Campamore, formerly of Eagle River, Alaska. Ms. Campamore, can you introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony?
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for having me here today via phone. My name is Danielle Campamore. I was born and raised in Eagle River, Alaska, but I currently live in Brooklyn, New York. I will begin today just by giving you a little background. I grew up in a home riddled with domestic violence. My father was physically abusive as well as verbally and financially. When my mother became pregnant with me, she was forced to leave her work, so she was financially dependent on my father. My first memories are of extreme physical violence. When I was around 14 or 15 and started getting my period, I experienced extreme pain. I was throwing up every month. I would miss school for a few days. And this turned out later to what I later found out to be endometriosis. My mother at the time knew that birth control could help mitigate some of the side effects of endometriosis. And I broached the topic with my father and was immediately beaten because in his eyes, birth control, one, is only used for one thing, and two, was a sign that I was going to be getting more freedom in my life, freedom that he couldn't allow me to have. And so we had no way of me procuring any sort of birth control. Again, we were financially dependent on my abusive father. My mother was not allowed to go anywhere without his permission. That included doctor's offices, even the dentist, for fear of what she may say to a health professional. So we had no idea what to do. Thankfully, there was a Planned Parenthood in Anchorage, Alaska, where we were able to procure affordable birth control that I was able to pay for myself so that nothing would show up on a bill that my father might find later. And I was able to kind of help myself with the effects of endometriosis and not miss any school. But I was only able to get birth control 3 months at a time, and trying to navigate the complexities of making my way to a pharmacy to fulfill a prescription without my father knowing, and this is probably even more so a difficult part for my mother, was unbelievably difficult and scary. When you live in an abusive home and you are essentially at the will of someone who uses abuse to control your every life, every part of your day is riddled with fear. You have no idea what will set them off, and you have no idea what kind of person you're going to be having to deal with day to day. And we have no idea how we were going to be able to continue for me to have access to this birth control that was giving me some relief. and still stay safe. And this says nothing of the woman in romantic relationships trying to do the same. Thankfully, we were able to do so for a little bit of time. Eventually, I did get caught with birth control and suffered because of it, which is another reason why other forms of birth control are so important, including IUDs and patches, where pills aren't necessary. But I have seen the effects of domestic violence and how birth control can give a tiny bit of...
Oh, Danielle, you're cutting out. We can't hear you.
She's a 15-year-old.
Could you repeat? Could you just repeat the last line or so? We lost you for a minute.
Oh, sorry. I've seen the effects of domestic violence and how the ability to procure birth control can give a victim a tiny bit of control and freedom over her life, even if it is just a small part of her life, whether that victim is a 15-year-old girl trying to go to school or an adult hoping to one day leave an abusive relationship. And so I 100% support this bill and hope that it passes. I know that the Alaskan women desperately need affordable access to birth control.
Thank you very much for sharing your story with us, Danielle. I imagine that this was uncomfortable for you to do, and you're also navigating a four-hour time difference, so I appreciate that very much. Does anybody on the committee have any questions for Ms. Campamore? All right, well, I have a couple here. So from your perspective, how would having a 12-month supply of contraception help somebody who is experiencing contraceptive coercion?
Yes, ma'am. Again, it is the ability to leave 3 months at a time. It sounds so easy to someone who isn't used to being in an abusive relationship or in an abusive situation, but consistent trips to even a pharmacy, to anywhere where you don't want your abuser to know where you are or where you're going, is extremely difficult and extremely scary. To be able to allow women one trip and they're set for an entire year, in no uncertain terms will keep these women safer and give them, hopefully, the ability to take that next step towards potentially leaving an abusive relationship or an abusive and dangerous situation.
All right, thank you. Representative Sadler, you had a question?
Thank you, Major, I do. Ms. Campbell, I hope you can hear me, but my wife and I have experienced the pain of endometriosis, both in physical pain on her part and on the infertility on our part, so I feel for it and appreciate you coming forward with your information, your story. But you're far away from Eagle River now. Can you tell me, in your information, how many women in Alaska do use birth control for medical purposes, like ameliorating the effects of endometriosis versus what I'll call just simply birth control, contraceptive?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that last part? I didn't quite
sure.
Hear you.
How many women in Alaska use birth control for medical reasons, such as amelioration of endometriosis, versus solely for contraception?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure that I can answer that question, just because that would involve me knowing the medical choices of women in their medical history, which obviously I'm not privy to. So I don't know the reasons why Alaskan women use birth control. I do know that 59% of adult women in Alaska experience inter partner violence, and 30% of Alaskans are not able to access victim services or encourage others to do so because they don't have services in their area, particularly women who live in rural areas in Alaska. But the reasons why women procure birth control run the gamut from endometriosis to PCOS, to even just painful cramps, to a wide variety of reasons. And as I'm not in the doctor's office with them, I don't know the medical reasons why they choose contraception.
Thank you. A follow-up. So I'm not quite sure. Are you speaking of just your personal story, or are you an expert in the field? Do you have information about public health statistics in Alaska? Help me understand, in addition to your personal story, what your credentials are in this issue.
No, this is absolutely my personal story, but just because I live in New York doesn't mean I don't care about my home. I am an editor in New York. It was my dream to be an editor in New York, and thankfully I was able to leave my abusive situation. because I was able to go to college and fulfill that dream. But I also believe in giving back to my community. So I volunteer for a lot of domestic violence-related organizations, including Day One here in New York and Youth Voices Network, trying to combat systemic sexual violence. And, of course, I think about my home in doing so. So I research a bit.
And I'll just follow up. You're not the only Chuki actor in Eagle Rook Island, New York. My daughter's in college in Manhattan, so see if you see Mason, say hi.
All right. I had another question, Ms. Campamore. What, in your opinion, do you think that long-acting reversible contraceptives aid to those that are suffering or could be experiencing from contraceptive coercion?
Yes, ma'am. I do, and I think that's why it's important that all forms of birth control are considered, you know, IUDs, patches, shots, especially when you consider women who are in abusive situations. Those clearly are obviously easier to conceal. So the choices that they're making for their bodies and with their doctors aren't as obvious to the abuser. Again, I was able to procure birth control, but I also got caught with birth control, and I was beaten because of it. I can only assume that there are plenty of other women in Alaska who have faced similar situations and circumstances. So, yes, I believe long-form birth control would also be extremely vital.
Yeah. Do you have any other recommendations that we might consider looking to prevent contraceptive coercion?
Oh, how much time do you guys have? I 100% believe that this is the first step. I think open dialogue fits this, obviously. I also think it's a well-known fact that Alaska has a horrific domestic violence and sexual assault problem, and this is really just one small part of that. But I think affordable access to birth control is a big part. Maybe one day I'll come back and run for public office, and we'll see. But I don't know.
Run, sister, run. All right. Does anybody else have any other questions for Ms. Campamore? Oh, Representative Tarr.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for being willing to share your personal story. Of course, it underscores what we know is sort of the root problem in domestic violence in terms of power and control, and how this is, one way in which, those individuals use that power and control is to control the inability, the woman's ability to be able to manage her own reproductive needs, reproductive health care needs. So I just appreciate that you were willing to come forward and share your story and help us understand that point of view. Thank you.
No, of course, thank you so much for allowing me to share my story with you all. It is very appreciative, and I am very thankful for the opportunity.
All right. It looks like we have one more question for you from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Campamore, you described some awful situations which occurred in your family growing up. And my question to you is, to what degree are we trying to solve a problem that's actually domestic violence and abusive parenting issues, and as opposed to specifically about limitations on contraceptive prescriptions? How much of this is a DV issue? How much is a contraceptive issue?
Thank you, sir, for that question. I think it's both. I think that they go hand in hand. Domestic violence is insidious in nature, and the ways in which an abuser will try to control their victim are certainly endless, and there are multiple ways that happens. But really, birth control, it seems like such a minor part of a woman's life, but it isn't. That is, we're talking about a woman really protecting herself from future abuse. The majority of women who are abused by a partner are also raped, and that doesn't matter if the woman's married to the man. My mother was married to my abusive father for over 25 years, There are plenty of times in which she raped her, and her ability to have birth control made sure that she didn't have more children that kept her in an abusive situation. And that is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why my mother stayed, is because she had two children to take care of. And so again, it seems like such a small life choice going on a birth control pill, but it is such a vital part of a woman hopefully potentially taking that first step. I think that if we really want to combat domestic violence in Alaska, we need to look at all avenues in which domestic violence is able to run rampant, and birth control is one of those ways where we can assist women and eventually give them the help that they need.
Madam Chair, I hope that we do have the chance to have public health experts who do have the issue and will testify to us to get answers that are applicable to the entire state, not just in a single person's experience as an inmate. Thank you.
Thank you for the suggestion, Representative Sadler. All right, so seeing no further questions for Ms. Campamore, we're going to move on to hear from Ginny Walsh, who's the program coordinator at Arctic Women in Crisis in Utqiagvik. Ms. Walsh, can you please introduce yourself and give us your testimony today?
Yes. Hi. My name is Virginia Walsh, and I'm the program coordinator at Arctic Women in Crisis in Utqiagvik. I want to thank the committee for your time, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 25. Contraceptive coercion is in part about victims often not having the understanding that this form of coercion counts as an abuse tactic in the cycle of power and control. In this way, contraceptive coercion is especially dangerous because it often builds on other abuse. It builds on mental, economic, physical, sexual abuse. At our shelter, we work with women who report that their partners have sabotaged their birth control and have not supported their decision about when or if they want to have a baby. Some of our women report being threatened by their partner, who has become violent if they didn't comply with their wishes to continue a pregnancy. Education, medical screening, and other prevention tools are urgently needed, and this bill, if passed, can provide one more tangible support to victims. This is because comprehensive insurance coverage of contraceptives offers victims a greater variety of options, such as what Danielle mentioned, the provision in the bill that provides access to a 12-month supply of contraceptives that then women can use in safety planning and in trying to maintain healthy relationships. Harm reduction intervention for this group of women needs to include steps which ensure affordable access to emergency contraception, and this bill creates zero copay for these services, and access to forms of contraception that are less susceptible to detection and tampering. When your life is being controlled by somebody else, even something that may seem to be pretty mundane, such as access to affordable birth control and avoiding pregnancy, that's a step toward being free and to being safe. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I urge you to pass House Bill 25.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh, for your testimony. Do we have any questions for Ms. Walsh? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, of course, this would be anecdotal unless you've worked with, a university researcher or someone to sort of collect data. But Representative Sadler had some questions sort of trying to direct the conversation back towards home, if you will, from this, individual who's, living out of state at the time, at the current time. But, you're sort of talking in generalities about things you hear from women you interact with. But I guess could you talk a little bit about the frequency at which you are hearing those things to give us a sense of, sort of how often does a woman come into shelter and talk about this as part of the, a cycle of abuse that she was experiencing in her own situation?
Let's see. To the chair, to begin answering this question, Representative Tarr, I can't give you exact statistics. I know the other morning I talked to a young woman who was, felt that she was being forced to continue in a pregnancy that she did not want to, and she was afraid of the violence which is escalating in the relationship. I could tell you that perhaps once a month, someone talks to me about access to birth control and about, you know, their desire to either terminate or to continue a pregnancy, that they feel that they don't have self-determination. But exact statistics, I can't give you that.
Thank you. And that's sort of where I was going. I think it's just the folks that are doing the work every day can give us a better sense of how often this is coming up. And, I mean, for me, that tells me that this is a regular occurrence in your work. And certainly we know things are underreported for all types of abuse. So that, you know, isn't an indication that every woman that's experiencing this is telling you about it. But, I mean, if it's happening with that regularity, then, right, you're just one of the 25 shelters in the network. And if all 25 shelters are having, you know, this happening on a regular once-a-month basis, you know, I don't know that that's true, but just gives us a sense of you know, how much it's a part of the problem, and that tells me it's a big part of it.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, and often I'm sure it is underreported, and it takes a long time to form a relationship with someone where they often feel comfortable to reveal this, that, you know, that they feel that they, you know, are being pressured, and so thank you for pointing that out.
I knew you were waiting. I knew you were waiting for one. All right.
Anything, but you gave me the eyesight. So I would just caution us that
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the fact that we're having discussions. This is an important issue, and I do want to make sure that we are informed by evidence and defensible statistics and sampling, and not driven or guided by anecdotes and assumptions. Thank you.
I'm sure you don't mean to suggest that people's the experiences these women are talking about are not valid.
Absolutely, I'm not saying that.
All right. All right. So, seeing another questions from anybody else, Virginia Walsh, I'd like to ask you a question or two myself. So, you know, are you familiar with the bill HB 25 that we're considering in the legislature?
Yes, I am.
How do you see a bill like HB 25, you know, affecting women that are experiencing domestic violence and helping them to respond to? How does this empower them to respond to contraceptive coercion, in your mind?
Yeah, no, I think that if women have access to emergency contraception, and if they have access to forms of contraception that are less susceptible to detention and tampering. You know, for example, an IUD or the subdermal implant, and there are zero copays, you know, that gives you much more freedom and many more options, and I think that's what's extremely important. So you have your self-determination, and you can choose whether you want to continue in a pregnancy, whether you want to become pregnant. And, you know, once you take that one step forward towards safety and freedom, then that's extremely important for you and, you know, if you want to have a child. So I think this bill is extremely important.
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, of course, will be a bit anecdotal from my own experience when I was the director of the Alliance for Reproductive Justice. But we helped women access services. We were not a direct service provider, but often that wasn't known to the individual when they first made the phone call. And I think one piece of it we also want to remember, and perhaps Ms. Walsh will want to comment on this, is that many of these women have children already. And so this decision, you know, a lot of times in the experience that I had in working with women was really wanting to keep the children they have safe and recognizing the challenges with, you know, being in this abusive situation. Already having a difficult time feeling like they were able to care for their children and keep them safe. And so, you know, we know how harmful it is for children to be exposed to violence, you know, whether to themselves or in the family. And as we think about steps where we could prevent that going forward, you know, I think this is a part of that conversation where this, again, as it's sort of been mentioned, you know, may give the woman more of an ability to leave that abusive situation, but also protect children that they're trying to parent and keep safe. And
yeah.
Ms. Walsh, I'm sorry, that was just more of a comment from the experiences in my director's role, but maybe you have something to add to that.
Yes, and also I think, you know, one of the stories that I was told that was extremely moving for me was one of our participants have said that she was forced to continue in a pregnancy that had impacted her health, and you know, she was a mom with other children, and of course that impacted the whole family. And so exactly what you said about trying to keep the family that you have and trying to be the best mom that you can. And so it's extremely important, again, that women have access and options to birth control.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Walsh. You were helpful in illuminating some of the challenges that women in domestic violence experience. I think we had planned on another bit of testimony, but our third testifier is not on the line right now. Should we proceed? At ease. Go ahead and set aside I want to thank both Danielle Campamore and Virginia Walsh for taking time to talk with us today, as well as Representative Matt Klayman for bringing this issue to the attention of the committee. Now we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 162, which deals with the laws governing the Department of Health and Social Services background check system. Stacey Crailey, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, would you please come forward? All right. Put yourself on the record, introduce the bill, and provide us with a sectional analysis if you can. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stacey Crailey, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And I thank you for the opportunity to appear today and present House Bill 162. I'd like to provide a very brief kind of overview of the bill, and then I'll go into a sectional analysis. And, of course, if you have any questions throughout the presentation, feel free to ask. As a starting point, I'd like to note that participation in a number of federal programs such as Medicaid and foster care requires states to conduct criminal background checks before licensure or payment for services. The State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has been doing background checks for many years, and in particular in 2005, this legislative body passed a bill which codified a background check process for all persons who are paid for in whole or in part by the Department of Health and Social Services. Those statutes can be found at Title 47, Chapter 5, Section 300. Since that time, a background check conducted by the Department of Health and Social Services has conducted of basically two parts. The first part is a fingerprint-based criminal history check, and that would be a check of all state and federal criminal offenses that may arise through a fingerprint background check. The second part of the background check is what is called the civil history check. The civil history check comprises of a check of a number of various databases, some of which are federally managed, some of which are state managed. For example, the Office of Inspector General exclusion list for Medicare and Medicaid, another sex offender registry list managed both by the federal government and the state government, the certified nurses aid registry that's managed by the Board of Nurses here in Alaska. Those are the registries that we're talking about. And so since 2005, that process has been engaged in for anybody who has applied to be a foster parent, a personal care attendant, etc., in the Department of Health and Social Services. However, since that time, as we've operationalized the statute, as is evidence with many statutory schemes, we've identified a number of gaps, overlaps, inconsistencies, some language that wasn't crystal clear that could have been a little bit clearer, and we've identified those items as best we can and have addressed many of those issues through the regulatory process. But there are certain things that just simply need to be fixed in statute, and that's why we're here with this bill. Very broadly, what this bill does is that it clarifies that a civil history check is a check of already existing registries. Originally, the bill kind of contemplated that we would create a standalone registry, and we never did that because, one, it wasn't operationally feasible, and it wasn't fiscally feasible. So we look at existing registries and identify that information, and we clarify that in this bill that we're not creating a standalone registry or standalone database that is managed by the department. It also clarifies that background checks are required not just of entities, and when I use the word entity through this presentation, when I speak of an entity, I'm talking about a licensed entity. The statute, as it's currently drafted, contemplates that entities are subject to background checks, and it's not very clear that they're, all of their employees are, and in particular as to the civil history check. This legislation fixes that oversight and makes it clear that not only the people who own the businesses, but the people that work for the businesses have to go through this background check. It further renames the two registries that exist currently in state law, one of which is currently called the Central Registry, and the other one is the Centralized Registry, which causes a wee bit of confusion. So we've renamed those registries to a Civil Registry and to a Child Protection Registry to avoid that confusion. It also makes amendments to Title 47, Chapter 32, which is the licensing provisions of DHSS, and manages oversees or addresses all of the licensed entities for DHSS. And it does three major things within Title 47, Chapter 32. It allows licensing investigators to share licensing investigations with law enforcement when there's concurrent investigations as a matter of law. As the statute is currently crafted, we believe that we need releases of information, we need search warrants, we need court orders to share information with law enforcement. We think that's not efficient or an effective way to communicate when there's a criminal offense that has occurred at a licensed facility. We also make a change in this bill which allows the licensing divisions. So when the bill was first crafted in 2005, all licensing was under one division. Since then, it has sent out and spread out amongst three divisions. And what we want to be able to do is that if you're a licensing worker for OCS, you can talk about licensing investigations with the licensing worker in child care and also in healthcare services for assisted living, so that when there's individuals who are trying to be licensed or participate in all three programs, we're making the best decisions for health, safety, and welfare. So this legislation will fix that omission that exists in the current statute for sharing that information. Finally, and I think one of the most important parts of this legislation is that this allows the division to investigate individuals who have been accused of abusing, neglecting, or exploiting a individual who's in care. The current legislative scheme contemplates that entities can be investigated for abuse, neglect, exploitation, or some sort of other event. But as the best way to explain it, if I'm working as an assisted living home employee and I actually abuse or neglect an individual in care, I can't be individually investigated. The entity that I work for can, and regardless of whether or not they have made all appropriate remedial actions, they've fired me, they've reported me to the police, they've taken all of these remedial actions and done everything correctly, I still can't be investigated, only they can. The changes to this legislation will amend the statute to make sure it's clear that individuals can be investigated, and yes, they will be investigated, they will be notified of the investigation, they will get the reports of investigation, they will be allowed to appeal those findings and challenge any things that they disagree with. But this is a gap in the current statute that we think should be fixed. So that's a very broad overview of what the bill does. And with that, unless there's questions, I'm happy to go through a sectional analysis.
All right. I think you can proceed with your sectional analysis.
Okay. So I can't make this any more exciting than it is.
Riveting, I assure
you. Yeah, they are riveting. Section 1 of the bill will make conforming edits to rename the Centralized Registry to the Civil Registry to avoid confusion under the current law with the Centralized Registry, which is currently in 4705330, versus the Central Registry, which can be found in AS 4717040. Section 2 and 3 are amendments to current law that clarify that barrier crimes apply to individuals as well as entities. Section 4 is a section that would amend 4753, that's a typographical error. It's 4705310E to allow an individual to seek a background check. Currently, while we allow individuals to do that as a matter of regulation, the statute's a little ambiguous on that part, so individuals were not allowed to seek a background check on their own. We want the statute to be clear that individuals as well as an employee on behalf of an employer on behalf of an employee can do that. So Section 4 makes it clear that an individual can seek a background check on their own accord without having to be employed by an individual. or an individual entity. Section 5 would amend 4705.310F to make it clear that the DHSS may, in addition to exceptions to the barrier crime provisions, provide for variances to a barrier crime. Section 6 amends 4705.310H to address how non-licensed providers, such as a relative who is receiving payment for the Office of Children's Services, is treated under the statute. Specifically, and in shorthand, this means that if you are a relative placement for a child in foster care, you don't have to be licensed. So if the standard for a background check is you have to be paid in whole or in part, but you're a relative placement, you're not generally paid by OCS to provide care, you still have to have a background check, and that's federally required. So that section clarifies that. Section 7 is, again, a conforming edit to rename the centralized registry to avoid the confusion that I spoke of previously. Section 8 adds a new section to 4705.310 to address immunity from civil or criminal liability for reporting during the background check process. Section 9 provides a similar framework for the civil registry checks as background checks. Under the current statute, they kind of intermingled with each other, so there was references to both civil histories and criminal histories in both of the statutes, and what we did is we bifurcated them. So this is the one about civil histories, and make it very clear that that's all that's what it applies to. And so what this does is it creates a standalone provision as to civil registry checks and makes it clear that those registry checks are part of the background check process. Section 10 repeals and reenacts how the department will review existing registries rather than create the standalone registry, as I mentioned earlier, which was both programmatically and cost prohibitive. It also identifies that what we're looking for are civil findings that are inconsistent with licensure or payment for neglectful or exploited behavior, and that the information contained as we gather this information and review it is confidential and not subject to a public records request. Section 11 would amend the current immunity section to reflect the changes to civil registry from centralized registry, so it's just a conforming edit for the changes. Section 12 establishes a new section to address the ability to seek a variance for any finding under this chapter and how to appeal a decision if you disagree with any decision. There is a variance process that's in place now. This just kind of comports with existing practice. Section 13 would amend 4705.390 subparagraph 6 to expand the definition of entity to include an individual service provider. Section 14 again goes to the renaming of the central registry maintained by the Office of Children's Services, so we now call it the Child Protection Registry to avoid confusion. Section 15 is a new subsection that will clarify that before a substantiated finding can be placed or can be reviewed as part of a child protection registry, that person must be afforded due process, notice, and an opportunity to challenge any finding that is made. Section 16, this section would make a conforming edit to 4732.010, replacing the centralized registry with the civil registry. Again, a conforming edit. Section 17 amends 4732 to provide DHSS the authority to consider prior adverse licensing actions in making decisions on whether or not to grant or deny a license or whether to place a condition on a license. Section 18 would make it clear, and this is the section that talks about individual employees affiliated with entities. This is the section that makes it clear that when an allegation that an employee or an individual affiliated with an entity is alleged to have engaged in behavior that would impact the health, safety, or welfare of a resident, the department may investigate that individual and issue a report of finding on that investigation. The section further provides that if the finding of abuse and neglect is substantiated through an administrative appeal process, that will become part of the civil registry review and may result in an individual being prohibited from employment or licensure in the future. This section would also make it clear that before such a finding can be used, that due process must be afforded, i.e., you must be notified of the allegation and an opportunity to challenge that. Section 19 is a technical fix, which would clarify when formal hearings are required when an enforcement action is taken after a licensing investigation. And these are fixes to the licensing provisions. Section 20 would add a new section to clarify when law enforcement is investigating a crime that is also subject to a licensing investigation. Material gathered by DHSS may be shared as a matter of law. Section 21, this section would clarify that all divisions who implement 4732 may share information with each other for purposes of administrating the licensing programs at DHSS. Section 22, this section would repeal references to provisions in the current law that are no longer necessary as a result of the previous 21 sections, kind of technical cleanups and changes. Specifically, this section repeals references to the civil registry when doing a background check. That's where we had the civil registry mentioned in the criminal background check statute, so it just kind of cleaning up some of those redundancies and inconsistencies. Section 23 is an applicability section for purposes of applying the criminal and civil background check for on or after the effective date of this this bill. And Section 24 is a section that would advise the reviser regarding title changes to reflect amendments to the Act, including the Civil History Registry, so there's technical changes. And Section 25 is an effective immediate effective date clause. That's
all right. Thank you. That was scintillating. All right. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Eastman, Representative Keto, then.
Thank you. And through the chair, on Section 20, we talked about sharing information between multiple investigations. I'm just wondering how that might work in reality. So in order to make that request, one agency would have to know that the other was investigating or had a similar investigation. How is that information normally shared?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it actually happens the most obvious circumstances are when there has been a crime that has been committed at a licensed entity like an assisted living home, and there is an immediate response by both DHSS and law enforcement. So we're both there at the same time, and we understand that there's concurrent investigations going on. In those instances, and we have access to a lot of information through our licensing files, in many of those instances, law enforcement asks for our licensing files, and for those provisions of the licensing file that are confidential, we are unable to share that information despite the fact that there's an ongoing criminal investigation. And so in most of those instances, we are in a concurrent investigation with them, and we have either invited the police and we've gone out with them, we have been invited by the police to go out with them, or that we, you know, frankly, show up at the same time. So it's pretty well known for most of these circumstances that there's a concurrent criminal investigation.
Representative Keto's next, and then Representative Edgman.
Thank you, through the chair. And thank you for coming by the office earlier, and we did have a brief conversation. One of the concerns I have is in regard to privacy. So right now, with respect to the different silos and in an investigation, a subpoena or however, you would have to get some kind of a formal legal document in order to get some information. Within that legal document, there are provisions for accountability. So an individual that is receiving information is very aware of the confidentiality and the privacy requirements of that information. If we remove that and we are expecting administratively that those actions will still take place, can you tell me who makes the individual requesting information accountable? I mean, who is the person that if for some reason, perhaps an accident, unintentional private information is accidentally released, how does that person who released the information, how is that person held accountable for that release?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, I'm going to ask, I think Margaret Brody's on the line, who's the Director of Healthcare Services, and she may be able to identify how they deal with that information now, because there is confidential information that exists throughout the Department of Health and Social Services, and I don't work for the Department of Health and Social Services, I represent them. So what I'd like to ask her is maybe she can identify, or if not, we can get back with you on how the department administers and monitors the confidential nature of, frankly, most of the material that is housed over there. So she may have something to add. If not, we will get back with you on an answer for that when we come back to the committee. I don't think we're moving this at any time soon, so we'll come back with an answer with you, but she may have something to add.
Did you want to follow up, or do you want to see if you got an answer from Ms. Brody?
Just a quick follow-up for context, and then maybe an answer from Ms. Brody. So for context, I guess the concern that I have is any time we have in a situation where we are authorizing more eyes to see particular pieces of information, we are making the opportunity for the release of that information increase. So even if it's ever so slightly, and if we don't have that signed accountability of individuals having to actually request legal documents, then I just want to make sure that provisions are in place within the department to make sure that those individuals' privacy and confidentiality concerns are maintained. And so right now that's being protected by the legal process. How are we protecting those individuals' privacy? And so that's more of a clarification of my question for Ms. Brody.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Brody, did you hear the question, and did you have a response?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. For the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services for the State of Alaska. Through the Chair, Representative Ito, we have many different types of security that apply to what we do, but for the background check, it's called CJIS security, and it actually is from the FBI. And everything that we touch in the system is in a log, and we're able to go in and check those logs and ensure, and there are audits to ensure that people have only gone where they need to go. If by any chance a document were misplaced or was missing, we would report that both to the AG's office and to public safety to let them know exactly what was going on. And a full investigation would be done through our department and the state's IT office, from public safety, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and then we would wrap it all up with the AG's office.
Does that answer your question?
A quick follow-up. So, Ms. Brody, thank you. And in regard, I guess, to that's how the situation happens currently, are the individual accountability procedures applicable if we remove the firewall of having to request information from another silo through a legal process?
Through the Chair, Representative Keto, the requirements do not change regardless. We still have the same requirements and accountability.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brody, I was going to ask you a question. I understand this is an opportunity to fill in some gaps, but can you give me an idea, and the committee an idea, of how many bad apples are now slipping through the cracks, if you use a vernacular? How many people are getting licensed having more consistent, more broad, and efficiently applied licensing background checks is going to fix? So what's the problem we're addressing? How bad is it?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, if an individual has any type of finding in their background check, we deny their clearance. And they may go through a variance process that involves all the divisions within the Department of Health and Social Services and the individual showing mitigating circumstances and explaining why whatever that finding was is no longer an issue. And it goes through this committee. They make a recommendation to the division director, who then makes a recommendation to the commissioner.
If I could redirect the question.
Yeah.
I guess I would ask Ms. Creeley that question. Again, I'm trying to get some idea. It's hard to ask, to know what you don't know, but how many people will this catch? How much finer will the CID be with this bill in place than it currently is?
Thank you, through the Chair, Representative Sadler. If I can give some individual statistics, and Ms. Brody can talk about these as well because these came from her, but I think what you're asking is last year in fiscal year 17, 23,175 individuals submitted information to go through the background check process at DHSS. From those 23,175, there were a total number of unique individuals, so of 556 who had barring conditions. So it's a very, so that's, according to their math, 3.2% of the individuals who have applied. Of those, 556 who were in unique individuals, so there may have been more hits, but they would have had maybe a barring condition, two or three crimes, so that would duplicate. Of those unique individuals, 185 requested variances of the department, and 158 of those individuals were granted variances.
Can you run down those numbers if I could again? So 23,175 people provided information for the background. 556 had barring conditions, disqualifying conditions. Mm-hmm. 185 got asked for variances, and 158 of that 185 got variances. Is that accurate?
185 requested variances, and 158 had variances approved. If that, I don't know if I heard that correctly.
So if I could ask a general question, how big of a problem is it that you're trying to address? I mean, I'm not seeing that an awful lot of people, it's hard to measure how many people are getting through that shouldn't get through or getting hired and potentially causing a risk or harm to protected people or what they might see facilities.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there, you know, the short answer to your question, there really isn't a problem for that purpose. We are capturing the people that we want capturing. We're identifying the people that we want to identify who have histories, both criminal and civil histories, that are inconsistent with licensure and that have a predictive factor in showing that they may be prone to abuse, neglect, or exploitation. So we feel that the program, as it's designed, works exceptionally well. What this bill is designed to do is to clean up some language and some confusion within the statute and within the process so that when the individuals who are subject to our process look at the statute, it reads a little bit better, it's more understandable, and it also allows us to clean up some of the languages and gaps that we think are identifying that, you know, for example, you know, that an individual who is the actual perpetrator of the abuse and neglect isn't the person who has the finding made against them. It has to be the entity. So it's a cleanup bill is what it is. And we've been looking at this for a long time. The bill has been around for 15 years. It works exceptionally well. But what we have identified, and we identified this many years ago, and as legislative processes work, we're now in front of you, and we're happy to be so. But it's taken a while to get to this point, although we've identified these issues many years ago.
Thank you. And through the chair, sometimes I do ask questions to elicit that from the public listening. I'm aware of some of these things, but I want to put a clear point on it. This is not a huge problem that needs to be addressed. You, as you say, you have a pretty good system. This makes it work better and clears up some ambiguities and consistencies. And that's a good touch point, though.
Thank you. Thanks. And my apologies, Representative Tarr. I skipped over you on the list. My
problem. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, I just was have a bit of curiosity about the info sharing portion of it in terms of. And this is just related to some work we've been doing on public safety issues. So, you know, once the individual gets the background check, that's they're using our existing DPS and FBI information, I think, for that, for any of the, you know, criminal history. But then, you know, if something comes up in the licensure part, I'm trying to understand if there could be a circumstance where that information might not have already been communicated to law enforcement or showing up in that. Could there, you know, and would you be able to eliminate that problem? Because one thing that's come up in some of the things that we've been working on is just some of the limitations to the multiple databases that mm-hmm. the state has. So there's, you know, the APSIN database, there's I'm going to forget the acronym for the other one, but, you know, one's the current cases, but that one's done not by individual but by case number. Then there's the one of closed cases, but that's the individual's criminal history. Then I think there's a third one. And then, you know, I guess you guys have some. Are these integrated in the best way possible, or are there other things we should be thinking about in terms of efficiency and sharing that information and making sure that, you know, we have it as up to date as possible for public safety, basically.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I think efficiency is a really good topic. It's a little bit beyond the scope of this bill, but to answer your question, the criminal background check. So there's CourtView, there's APSIN, there's JOMIS, which is the Juvenile Offender Management System, and so all of those are standalone databases. And I don't to say whether or not they. I don't believe they're integrated. You can't. They don't access each other. They're all. You have to go into those individually. The databases that we're accessing for civil history purposes are are civil findings, so that you would not find any of that information unless there was an you were charged and convicted of Medicaid fraud. That might show up on a criminal history check as well as on a civil registry, because that's part of the Office of Inspector General and our state exclusion list. So these registries, unfortunately, are standalone registries, and they don't interact together, but they're very efficient registries. So, like, if you wanted to go onto the OIG database, you could just type that right in and put in, you know, provider X and see whether or not they have any sort of findings. You know, a lot of these databases are, they're public in the sense that the name and a certain amount of information is there. The underlying information is not public, so it's just, you know, but a lot of this stuff, they're very efficient to use, and a lot of them are online, and anybody on the committee could look up whatever they wanted to look up. They're just things that we have identified as being the type of information that we want to look at, and so then it's easy for the background check unit in DHSS to, you know, type in somebody's name and say, are they on this exclusion list? And it's pretty efficient. They don't interact, but it's very efficient.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Representative Johnston.
I'm fine.
Oh, all right. I guess their questions have been answered. Is there any other questions? All right. I appreciate your presenting the bill today. We are going to go ahead and set this aside so people have the opportunity to sort of consider it in a little bit more detail. For the most part, this is a clean-up bill, but there's a lot of detail in there, and so I know that I'd like some time to read it. And then we'll pull it up in the near future to take amendments and listen to public testimony. We'll be sure to give you plenty of heads up and on that notice on that. So on Thursday, the HES committee will not be meeting. However, the HES finance subcommittee will be meeting at 3:45 in the same location, Capitol Room 106. So the time is 4:07, and this meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.